May you share something from your heart to our hearts, from your depth to our depths. Protect us from thoughts that are not from you. And may we know you and love you and be blessed together. Amen. I'm going to rip off a speech by an Irish Christian philosopher, thinker, kind of a mystic. His name is John Moriarty. And instead of paraphrasing it, I'm going to put a little paraphrase up there so you can read it. But I'm going to play, it's about 2.5 minutes. He has a beautiful Irish accent that sounds like a river, and he uses really cool words. So I thought, I don't know if you can see that, but if you can, you can hear it. I'll let you listen to that.
There's a man walking home late at night, and he walks those streets every night of his life for the last 30 or 40 years. He's been walking these streets, so he almost somnambulates down these streets when he comes to a turn. He doesn't have to think to go, I must now turn left or I must now turn right. He just does it almost in a somnambulating way. And he comes into his own street, and he's walking down past all the little familiar gates and the familiar doors, and a familiar dog would pass him by. And as he's approaching his own house, he puts his hand into his waistcoat pocket to retrieve the key to his house. But it isn't in the pocket where it normally is, and he's quite astonished at this. And he searches the other pockets, and it isn't there. And he turns all his pockets inside out, and no, there's no key to his house. And he sees a narrow, he's just further on than his own little gate, he sees a street lamp, and it's shedding a very narrow circle of light, a very precise and narrow circle of light on the ground. And he goes over and he starts walking around, remaining all the time meticulously within the little narrow circle of light, searching for the key to his house. And a local policeman comes along after a while and says, what are you doing there? And he says, I'm searching for the key to my house. So the policeman says, I'll help you. So the two of them start walking around in the narrow circle of light, and they can't find it, and they decide, well, they'll go down their hands and knees. So they go down their hands and knees, and they start walking around, and then one of them goes clockwise and the other goes anti-clockwise, and the policeman gets a ring in his head, and he's sure that the key isn't here. So he says, well, we're not finding it, are we? I don't think it's here. And the housekeeper looks a little bit astonished at the policeman. The policeman looks a bit astonished at the housekeeper. And but of course it isn't here, because I didn't lose it here. And the policeman says, like, where then did you lose it? And he said, I lost it over there in that dark corner. And then the policeman says, but why aren't you searching there? And the answer is, because there is no light there. Now, the point of the little parable is that we spend our whole lives searching for the key. There is a great mystery, and we spend our whole lives searching for the key to the mystery. And we think that we're going to find the key to the mystery and the answer to the mystery in the very narrow circle of sensory intellectual light. If we walk round that often enough and examine it minutely enough and perspicaciously enough, if we do that, then we're going to find the key to the key to the great mystery and the answer to all of life's riddles. But there's a whole mystical tradition almost, and every tradition says, no, you will not find the key to the great mystery. You will not find the key to your house, to your eternal house. You will not find that in the narrow circle of sensory intellectual light. You must go beyond the narrow, you must voyage out beyond the narrow circle of sensory intellectual light and go into the dark, and it is in the dark that you're going to find it. In other words, it's possible for a Christian to talk not just about the light of God, but to talk also about the darkness of God. Particularly after Good Friday, we can talk about the tenebrae and the darkness of God.
Use the word perspicaciously or something like that. I don't even know what that word is. I stole that clip for the same purpose today, using the metaphor of darkness and the story of a storm to explore the topic of the mysteries of our faith. We most often use darkness with a negative connotation because, well, we can't see in darkness. Scripture often refers to light as good, penetrating the darkness as evil, which is evil. Darkness means we do not see the way ahead. Our path is unknown and covered in mystery. We think of suffering and difficult circumstances as dark days, and they are. And while that is part of what darkness is, I also want to explore how the metaphor can be inverted and to talk about the idea of a beautiful darkness or a friendly night, about the mysteries that are life-giving, because mystery and darkness can be two-sided coins. The face of the coin on one side is the unsolved riddles, the unsolved conundrums, the circumstances we don't understand or the people we can't figure out. That can be maddening, frightening, and desperate darkness. On the other side, darkness can be awe-inspiring, restful, and protective. It can be the mystery that redeems and restores, a veil of grace that covers over a multitude of unsightly sins. These two sides of the coin came together for me in a Bible study that I participate in, where we have looked at the book of Mark. So I've picked up a theme or a thread in Mark and chosen a particular story there that hopefully weaves these ideas together. And before we get too abstract, let's turn there to the Gospel of Mark. Mark 4. Jesus has just talked to his followers about the parable of the mustard seed. I'm going to pick up in verse 35. He explained the parable to them. And Mark says, "With many similar parables, Jesus spoke the word to them as much as they could understand. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. But when he was alone with his own disciples, he explained everything." Then we have the story of the disciples in the boat, Mark 4:35 to 41. "That day, when evening came, he said to his disciples, 'Let us go over to the other side.' Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and asked him, 'Teacher, don't you care if we drown?' He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, 'Quiet, be still.' Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, 'Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?' They were terrified and asked each other, 'Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him.'" It's such a familiar story, and it almost feels trite and cliched. So to make it more fresh, let's imagine ourselves there. You are in a wooden boat, pitching and rolling from side to side. The joints in the wood are creaking. Wind is spitting slivers of water in your face. You have to squint your eyes to see the gray clouds on the horizon. The waters are an even darker gray and violently choppy. You know what's brewing. Panic is mounting. Fear is a fist around your sternum. You know that storms like these don't end well. And you see Jesus back in the back of the boat, resting peacefully. And the events of the past months in Galilee rush to your mind and flood your memory. Healings, parables, a paralytic let down a roof, stories about thorns and mustard seeds, angry Pharisees, demons, and lepers. Let's freeze that frame for a minute. This montage of scenes is in the unfolding of a theme that theologians have called the messianic secret. I've learned about this in the Bible study that we did, and it really generated a lot of thought for me, so we're going to dive into it a little bit. All over the countryside, Jesus was doing incredible things and then telling the disciples not to tell anyone. He was casting out demons, but not allowing the demons to identify him. He's healing people and then saying, "Don't tell anyone what I did." A blind man, lepers in Mark 1, and even later he heals a mute in chapter 7, and then tells him not to speak about it. Can you imagine being given the gift of speech and then asked not to talk about it? If this were today in our Facebook era, when we are so accustomed to disseminating information, it would be like Jesus is not updating his Facebook status. His privacy settings are strict, and he shares personal information only with friends. There's a little information on his profile, but he's not posting pictures, no mention of hobbies, a few quotes from the Torah. Other people are posting photos, tagging him, putting up his sayings. Silliness aside, it is difficult for us these days to not have and share information, and probably was for people then. They didn't have the temptations, however, of social networking. Jesus' actions were attention-getting, and at the same time, he was trying to divert the attention and almost hide his identity. This is confusing for those of us who love to discover and publicize incredible events. Jesus' puzzling way of disclosing identity is a salient theme in Mark's narrative. I'm not qualified to discuss the theological aspects of this motif, and I think there are a lot of theologians here who probably have a lot to say. Please do. But from reading up a bit on the messianic secret, there are different ways that scholars answer the question of why would Jesus use this method of marketing the information about his identity. Was it a question of timing? Was it that he didn't want to draw too much attention that would anger and threaten authorities until the time was right? Maybe the device was used because the secrecy emphasizes the revelation of Jesus as the Messiah as it unfolds toward the end of Christ's ministry, having a kind of crescendo effect. It could also be that the secrecy is emphasized in the gospel to bring out other different aspects of Jesus' identity. Perhaps Jesus didn't want people to know him only as a miracle worker, but he wanted them to listen to his teachings. If I were a disciple, this way of controlling the information might have been a bit confusing. The expectation in the first century might have been for a different kind of Messiah, a political redeemer, a public figure with a national agenda. But here we see the Son of God entering the world, proclaiming his kingdom on different terms and in unexpected ways. This secrecy and unexpected behavior may have contributed to the disciples' questions after the storm about who this storm calmer really was. Let's go back to the scene in the boat. What is Jesus doing while the storm is raging? He's sleeping on a cushion, a little detail that is in Mark but not in Luke or Matthew. It's as if he was ever so comfortable amid that chaos. They even had to wake him up. Maybe they didn't want him to go down with the ship, or more likely they expected something. However, at the end of the story, they were amazed that he could calm the waves. Isn't that what they expected him to do? Or did they only want comfort, some help bailing out the water? The scene reinforces the idea that the disciples don't fully know who they're dealing with. After Jesus tells nature to stop in its tracks and nature listens, he asks, "Why were you afraid and why do you still have no faith?" His response begs some questions of us. If Jesus had not stopped the storm, what was the alternate plan to bring them through it? Did he stop the storm because they couldn't take it anywhere or because they didn't believe that he would get to the other side? If they had had faith, what would that have looked like? Would they have all just rested there calmly on the cushions with Jesus? Jesus implies that because their faith was weak, they required a big show of power, a big miracle, proof. All this even after he has just told them that all you need is faith the size of a mustard seed. Jesus in the boat seemed to want his followers to know something about him already, based on the time that he spent with them. The crowds that surrounded him built up theories about who is this man? Is he a prophet? Is he demon-possessed? Jesus' actions and explanations perpetrated this mystery of his identity, and yet he wanted those close to him to see through it, because he had been giving them tools to do so. What clues did Jesus give them? Well, Mark chronicles a series of miracles. As well, in Mark 4, we see that he took time alone, as we read earlier, with the disciples to explain the parables. After the parable of the sower, he says, "Hidden things are meant to be disclosed and brought out into the open." As we read earlier, after he told them the parable of the mustard seed, it says that he explained everything. So there's a shroud of secrecy, but Jesus was revealing things. He was dispensing information about himself and who he was and about the kingdom of God. He was clearing up mysteries, but in sometimes an opaque way that confounded expectations. And still, after they see him silence that storm, the disciples who spent so much time with him ask, "Who is this?" The story offers a few themes, perhaps, that can connect to our own interactions with God. We see the mysterious power of God and his mysterious ways of using it. And we see in the disciples ourselves as humans trying to make sense of the information and experiences given to us. I want to step out of the story for a bit and just explore some of the ideas that it raised for me, and particularly one of the mysteries that the toughest mysteries that we're dealt. The questions of how and when and why did God and does God intervene in our world and in our lives and in our storms. Years ago, I went to see a film called Atash with Matt Dahl and Danny. I don't know if you remember. He got a speeding ticket that day. And Matt made a statement that I have remembered for years since then. The film was beautiful, although painfully slow and mostly silent. It was in Arabic with very little dialogue, portrayed a total of like five characters making charcoal. It was neither lighthearted nor straightforward, and we drove all the way to Haifa to see it. Afterwards, Matt said something to me that I'll never forget. He said to the effect of, "That film really made you work for it." And what I think he meant was that we, the audience, had to engage all our powers of observation and intuition to make meaning out of that story. I often find myself applying that idea to other situations. We are asked by art or life experience to do the work of making meaning and sense out of the stories given or shown us. I think that's what happens with Jesus' disciples in Mark's story. Maybe more generally, this exploration and meaning-making is a pervading theme in the story of our own faith and our spiritual journeys. Where do we gather evidence that scaffolds our own spiritual understanding? One of the students at the school where I work, one of the students' favorite subject is a class called Theory of Knowledge, in which they explore and evaluate different ways of knowing, looking at emotion and reason and senses and culture as the lenses and filters through which we gain and apply information. So what are our ways of knowing in a spiritual context? Our congregation regularly provides us ways of knowing about Jesus. We also have the texts, and here we have those who are informed enough about the ancient contexts and languages to give us a wealth of insight from those texts. We have each other's stories, weekly reminders of God's faithfulness, sometimes wrapped in the delightful packaging of Christine's humor. I don't know if she's there. We have the lives of people around us, the struggles they've endured, the adventures they've pursued, the character they exude. And we have our own life experiences that remind us of God's faithfulness. And there are also the intangibles, the times of prayer and contemplation that tune our hearts to Him. There is the physical landscape, which informs our understanding of His teachings, because we can walk the hills and feel the waters that He felt. And beyond that, we have the mysteries of creation and its beauty that provokes us to understand how inspired and glorious our Creator is. This is a kind of knowing that is an instinct or a feeling and a gift. I'm reminded of a story about my niece, Zoe. One morning at age 2, she looked out the window at the Indiana sky that stretches on for vast expanses over cornfields. The sun was rising, painting the sky in her favorite colors, blue, pink, and orange. She looked, turned to her mother and said, "Look, Mom, look what God made. It is not so hard for little ones to make sense of things." Probably for that reason, Jesus said people like them will enter the kingdom of heaven. Something about their purity and intuition directs them to the truth. And this might be how we know the really important things, like the trust that lovers have that their love is real, or the intuition that helps us discern someone else's feelings of sorrow or joy, or the unquestionable bond between a mother and child. This is a certainty beyond what we have evidence for. It is a gift given by the Spirit, a gift of faith that we can't manufacture. But we grow up and get a little jaded by what the fallen world has to offer and how we see or don't see God intervening in it, and we start to ask why. And sometimes all the evidence available doesn't bring meaning or sense or comfort, and we are left with mysterious ways of how God did or didn't interact with us. And there are times when that feels like darkness. And when faced with it, how do we relate to the idea that a power that is unfathomable and a mystery is beyond our understanding? I think sometimes we have extreme reactions that can be problematic. One extreme, you have those who enjoy the mystery so fully that they fall into a nihilistic despair. Everything is meaningless. The danger is that we allow the questions to make us believe that there is no sense, no design, and that there are only questions. C.S. Lewis critiques this way of looking at things, saying, "The point of looking through something is to see something through it." To extend the idea back to the story about the key, it's like instead of the guy looking for his keys in the light, he's only wandering around in the darkness. He's not even looking for anything. When we think there is no method and everything is arbitrary, we become listless or complacent in our faith, because eventually we stop asking questions, stop wrestling with God, stop digging through texts, stop trying to figure out the mysteries of who He is and how He enters the world. Another reaction, maybe on the other end, could be avoidance. This approach leaves no room for doubt, no room for questions, avoiding the mystery because we have to explain everything. We create stories to fit our own agendas and fit God in a little box. The danger of that is that it enables us to diminish the awesome nature of the Almighty. If everything is knowable, quantifiable, and explainable, we have perhaps ignored the grandeur of God, exchanged wonder and fear for overfamiliarity, reduced his identity to only that of a buddy or a pal or a warm, fuzzy caretaker. That image of him, the understanding of his identity that does not allow for the element of mystery, ignores the aspects of God's mysterious encounters with humanity. A former example that a professor once gave us was about someone thanking God that his toothbrush didn't fall into the toilet. There's a solid theory there, maybe based in the idea that God cares about the hairs on our head and cares enough to protect our toothbrushes from ruin. However, the theories fall apart when God does not act in the ways we want or need him to. The challenge for us is how we respond when God defies our expectations and the inexplicable happens. Because sometimes toothbrushes do fall in toilets, and God may not be so concerned about that. But rather than face those questions that are raised, we silence these conversations as undermining faith or unspiritual. But the reality is we can't always trace the hand of God. His path through our lives is not always illuminated. And to go back to the metaphor of darkness, this is the aspect of darkness and mystery that can be negative. Often we find ourselves in the darkness of circumstances that we can't understand, the darkness of not knowing the path ahead, of not understanding why suffering takes place, and the ways of God in the midst of it. C.S. Lewis wrote a novel called Till We Have Faces, in which one of the characters talks about the gods, which allegorically represent our God. And I'll put it up here so that you can read along. The character there gives voice to our struggle to understand how God is working in the world. She says, "I say the gods deal very unrightly with us, for they will neither, which would be best of all, go away and leave us to live our own short days to ourselves. Nor will they show themselves openly and tell us what they would have us do, for that would be too endurable. But to hint and hover, to draw near in dreams and oracles, or in a waking vision that vanishes as soon as seen, to be dead silent when we question them and then glide back and whisper words which we can't understand in our ears when we most wish to be free of them, and to show one that what they hide from the other, what is all this but cat and mouse play, blind man's bluff and mere jugglery? Why must holy places be dark places?" We are often thwarted and frustrated by this lack of understanding, which can birth deep disappointment or fear. And although difficulties such as suffering, sadness, loss are never to be trivialized or glorified or diminished, there are some redemptive aspects that come alongside pain. I'm not advocating quick fixes or silver linings, and not at all applying this to darkness of clinical depression or mental illness, but I'm talking about the common human struggles and the sometimes devastating storms that we find ourselves in. What is holy about those dark places? If holy places are where we meet God, then those times of darkness may be called holy. That kind of darkness demands that we rely on him at the same time as being confounded by him. We cannot see his face, understand his ways, so all we have left is to seek him. In darkness, we have intuition that shows us the way, but we don't have sight. And so at that time, the same time, we have fear. We approach and enter darkness with trembling, perhaps a fitting and apt response to holiness. Being in it is uncomfortable. We are vulnerable, needy, a little bit lost. Perhaps that is our proper place in the relationship. This may be why Jesus says that the poor in spirit, the spiritually weak and wanting, are blessed. Dark places can be holy places because they are places where grace can reach us. Darkness can also be holy because it helps us internalize the meaning of faith. As we approach and engage with the mysterious unknown aspects of God. In Letters from a Desert, a Catholic monk, Carlo Corretto, wrote, I put this one up there too. Yeah, it's long. A friendly night, a benevolent darkness with restful shadows. The friendly night is an image of faith. The darkness is necessary. The darkness of faith is necessary, for God's light is too great. It wounds. I understand more and more that faith is not a mysterious and cruel trick of a God who hides himself without telling me why, but a necessary veil. My discovery of him takes place gradually. On earth, such is the light, the infinity of the mystery, and the inadequacy of human nature, then I must penetrate it little by little. What is our life on earth if not discovering, becoming conscious of, penetrating, contemplating, accepting, loving this mystery of God's? There aren't that many mysteries, but there is one on which everything depends, and it is so immense that it fills the whole space. Human discoveries do not help us penetrate this mystery. Future millennia will illuminate no further what Isaiah said and what God himself declared to Moses before the burning bush. I am who I am. In this process of working out the mystery, however we gather evidence and in whatever circumstances it comes to us, it finds us searching for our keys both in the circle of light and in the darkness. We are looking for both who he is and how he is. We are looking for ways to deepen our understanding of the great I am. Let's go back again to the boat. The story concludes with the disciples and their question, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." What did the storm teach them? The man they were following had power over nature, and yet how were they to make sense of that? Jesus was not checking the boxes and saying, "I am the Messiah because of this, this, and this." He was leaving it for them to work out. The identity issue is posed through Mark's narrative, and we can't neglect that important scene later in Mark 8, where Jesus asks his followers, "Who do you think I am?" They state other people's theories, "You're Elijah, you're John the Baptist," and Simon answers, "You are the Messiah." In Matthew, it says, he answers, "You are the Son of the living God." And Jesus in Matthew calls Simon blessed, because Simon doesn't know by human means, but it was revealed by the Father. What we see here with Peter is that he had lots of evidence, conversation, relationship with Jesus, and Jesus was still checking in with him and the other disciples to see how he made sense of it all. And according to the Matthew passage, he didn't figure it out because he was so smart or contemplative, but because it was divine revelation. And then Jesus changes his name and gives Peter great authority. And in both the Mark and Matthew story, he again tells them to keep it a secret. We know now how the narrative progressed and ended. The disciples were given mysteries that they couldn't anticipate: death, resurrection, and ascension. Thank you. I love how this is reflected in church traditions. In some Catholic and Anglican Eucharist liturgies, they have the line, "Therefore we proclaim the mysteries of faith. Christ has died, Christ is risen, and Christ will come again." The church proclaims it. We do not apologize for the mystery. And we are saying, yes, these spectacular claims of the incarnation, resurrection, and the identity of the risen Son of God are our starting point and center. It is more than our intellect can accept or integrate, and to embrace and proclaim that mystery demands our faith. In thinking about speaking today, I wasn't and I'm not sure what kind of practical real-world message this might offer. But if we want to use the metaphor of storms, the storms around us are not hard to identify. We live in a tumultuous and unpredictable region where people act on their hatred in violent ways, where nations go against each other, where humanity is stripped. Believers are targeted or threatened for their faith. And we are not in peaceful waters even within our own faith at times. And as a community, people around us experience crises like thunder going off beyond our control from surprising locations. And as well, there are internal storms, darkness that is more terrifying than beautiful, pain or sorrow that just plain hurts, and times when we want desperately for God to reveal himself or show the way forward to relieve our fears and pain, and we feel he may be silent, asleep in the back of the boat. The beauty of those storms is that we can offer much. We can offer much to the stormy scenes, and in fact, we can play a critical role for each other and for others on a larger scale. But I think we have to be mindful that in doing so, God's ways are still mysterious. We must use discernment in building and sharing our theories of how he plans to work in the world. On a national level, we could use our ideas about how God interacted in the world to subdue others, to perpetrate injustice, as Christians, that is in our history. But on a personal level, when we or others are going through storms, we can also be careless, even if well-meaning, with our opinions about God's providence or our theologies about suffering in ways that crush people who are struggling. So then what is our role? What do we have to offer? What we have to offer can be our stories of God's faithfulness or lessons learned, but those are important only as they point towards the man in the back of the boat. I can speak for myself that on a personal level, life often feels quite stormy, and it begs the question, who am I in that storm? I work in a school, and if you've ever heard the phrase storm in a teacup, anytime you have that many people from that many different backgrounds and personalities spending that much time together, it can be like a whole tea service full of little china teacups full of storms. And I can imagine that working in ministries or functioning even in families sometimes feels like that. And again, who are we in those storms? Repeatedly, for myself to answer that question, I must battle with my laziness and go back to the question of who is he? Recently, at a church retreat that we went on, I was hoping God would give some answers about some particular questions. I was hoping he would show up and not only connect with us as a congregation, but connect with me. And for heaven's sake, let me know what the plan is. Psychologists like to talk about stages of emotional, moral, physical development. And we can also talk about spiritual development. I've been through stages of enthusiasm, of childlike faith, youthful idealism, of adolescent questions and rebellion, of adult cynicism and independence and resistance, and I'll probably go back through all of them again. I experienced the peaks of waves, feeling particularly close to God, in the relationship with God at times, and the trough of waves, feeling sometimes distant. Lately, I've experienced a strong sense of security in the relationship, and also a sense of mystery, which is probably why I'm talking about this today, of how God is really intervening in my life. And in a selfish way, what is he doing for me and with me? When we took communion on the retreat, Joe was talking about the very physical act of breaking bread, and it reminded me powerfully of the act of Jesus' body being broken. These are not new stories to a missionary kid like me. I have believed since I knew I was a sinner around age 4, when I was throwing fits about getting a haircut and putting barrettes in my hair. Even then, I knew I was such a perfectionist, I knew I couldn't bear the idea that I would go to bed imperfect with all my sins, so I probably asked Jesus to save and forgive me from them every night. And from the time I first learned that's what his business was. Over time and circumstance, and lately in part of this Bible study group, my picture has taken on a new complexity. And he's not only the Sunday school stories. Yet with the breaking of bread, I was returned to a very basic tenet of our faith. Every day, I still commit sins. I am self-centered, passive-aggressive. I neglect someone. I'm not always straightforward, terribly anxious and lacking trust. I get impatient. I judge. I'm gluttonous. And all of that is just a normal day. For someone who likes to make everything right, I can't fix all that. I don't like for people to do my work or to depend on others to right my wrongs. I'm an independent, resourceful woman who doesn't like to ask for help too often. But there is nothing I can do to repair the damages that I've done or to fix those mistakes. And there are billions of me on this planet, and there have been more that already lived and died. And he took upon himself mine and all their sins, and not only the sin, but the struggles, the loneliness, the fears, all the pains of countless souls. That was an unbearable darkness. But that is one that gives us life because we are healed by those stripes. And that is a mystery, and I've heard it a million times, but internalizing it again was pivotal. The reminder, and communion is a good reminder, of what Christ did provokes me to work out what it means to live in that redemption and to do the work, to solidify what it is that I'm and who it is I'm supposed to be in the storms. Because the meaning we make of Christ's identity and vocation determines how we behave in storms. Perhaps the central theme in Mark's story in the boat is less the miracle and more the questions asked. Jesus asks, "Why are you so afraid and don't you have faith?" He asks for trust even without full understanding. I don't think this story promises or emphasizes that he will miraculously intervene in our situations, although he certainly demonstrated that he's able to do so. The calming of the storm left the disciples afraid and amazed, not assured and confident. They were left asking the question, "Who is this?" even after Jesus displayed great power. So we can rely on our knowledge of his many provisions and interactions in the world, but that kind of knowledge can be incomplete and the theories only selectively applicable. As we find ourselves in the middle of storms and darkness that is either difficult or beautiful or both, perhaps what this story has to offer is not so much the assurance of a way forward out of the storm, but more the challenge of getting to know the man in the storm, of trusting him, and of letting his mysterious identity transform who we are.